At the Starship Congress with David Brin, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome, I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society, with more of the human adventure across our solar system and way beyond. Icarus Interstellar's Starship Congress just wrapped up in my hometown of San Diego, California. I wasn't surprised to see the great science fiction author and futurist there. You'll hear me talk with David about the moon versus asteroids as solar system destinations, and much more. Our Milky Way galaxy has at least 54 little buddies, dwarf galaxies that hang out with us. That's just one of the great space facts we'll hear from Bruce Betts in this week's What's Up. We'll start with Emily Lakdawalla, editor of the Planetary Society's magazine. The September Equinox edition has just been published. Emily, congrats on yet another great issue of the Planetary Report. The paper copy, mine is in my hands as we speak, but of course it's available online as well to everybody, whether they are members of the Planetary Society or not, at planetary.org. It's a great issue. There's so much here. There's no way we're going to be able to cover all of it. I will say that beginning with the cover, you have a nice celebration of light sail. Not surprising, and very welcome. And there's some great stuff inside, including a nice message from our boss, the science guy. I'll also note there's a little tiny sidebar here about International Podcast Day, which has the logo of my favorite podcast, Planetary Radio. But what are your favorites out of this issue?
Well, this magazine gives me the opportunity to talk to scientists and engineers and get them to actually write for me about the missions that they're working on, other projects that they're working on. And in this particular issue of the magazine, I managed to rectify an absence from the Planetary Report for a long time, and that is an absence of Venus. We have a great article about Venus science from Javier Peralta, summarizing what we've learned from two fantastic missions, European Space Agency's Venus Express and Japan's Akatsuki, both of them investigating Venus's atmosphere. And I learned so much editing this article about how many different layers there are to Venus's atmosphere and clouds and how they all communicate with each other, or in some cases not. Akatsuki's still there doing science. And I'm just so pleased that we have this great article about Venus.
And we're going to have Javier Peralta, the author of this piece, on the show fairly soon. He's been out of town. We're just waiting for him to come back so that we can record a conversation. Speaking of those layers of atmosphere, it's another great thing that you find in these features in the Planetary Report. There's a great graphic that very graphically shows these layers. It's pretty, but it's also very instructive.
Yeah, that's another thing I really like about editing this magazine is I can make graphics that I will use again later. And I've never, you know, I've thought a lot before about Venus's atmosphere. I know it's thick. I know there's sulfuric acid clouds, but I didn't realize how high above the surface those clouds are, that there's three different cloud layers. You know, we could send spacecraft down that could just get underneath the lowermost cloud layer and would be able to see the surface with cameras. We should be flying around there in balloons.
Yeah, we sure should. There's a lot of other good stuff here in that article. And then it goes right on to one about planetary defense with author Vishnu Reddy, who has already been interviewed for Planetary Radio, and we'll be hearing from him in a week or two right here.
Yeah, I love doing articles like this where we can get updates on what's going on topics that are of great importance to the Planetary Society, because it helps, you know, it helps me understand how to talk about an issue like planetary defense with the public. In this article, it explains that we've actually probably discovered the asteroids that could potentially cause civilization-ending disaster. And the good news is there's no asteroid currently known that could cause civilization-ending disaster. So the search has moved on now to what they call the city killer asteroids, the ones that, you know, that would ruin your whole day if they landed on New York. Now, it's likely, because Earth is mostly empty and it's mostly ocean, that an asteroid of that size would impact in a place where it may not cause any major problem to humans, unless it caused like a tidal wave or something. But it's great to get an update on this, find out how we're looking for them, find out where we need to put our efforts in order to find them. Hazards like the ones that come from the direction we can't see, like coming out of the sun, which is why we need future spacecraft like NEOCAM that could orbit between Earth and the sun and be able to see those potentially hazardous asteroids. It's just a real great update, and Vishnu's a great writer.
And he's a great guest on Planetary Radio as well, as people will hear very soon. If you don't mind, I want you to comment on this last feature on the inside back cover of the magazine called Why I Explore. And it has this nice little essay by our chief operating officer, Jennifer Vaughn.
It's important to me as an editor of this magazine to reflect the fact that although, you know, space is about the places we explore and the spacecraft that we explore it with, ultimately it's a human endeavor. And so I really wanted to get a bunch of different voices on why we explore. It's one of the more common questions I get asked when I do radio interviews, like, why is it worth it? You know, why spend money on space missions when we have so many problems to solve here on Earth? And I started out with our COO, Jennifer Vaughn, and she has her own perspective. And I really look forward to exploring the diverse perspectives of other Planetary Society members from all over the world, from all different walks of life, to see why different people want to explore space. And that will, I think, really help inform us as the Planetary Society in the kinds of activities that we do in the future.
Besides, it's inspiring. You have a link here that tells people how they can get in on this.
Yes, that link is planetary.org/whyexplore. And we really do invite people to come explain to us why they think it's important to explore the solar system.
It is a terrific issue of the Planetary Report. Again, it's available at planetary.org. Keep it up.
Will do, Matt.
That's Emily Lakdawalla, our senior editor, and also now the editor-in-chief of the Planetary Report. If you know science fiction, you probably know the work of David Brin. His Uplift series alone could have justified his fame. It explores a universe in which all intelligent species have been uplifted by earlier species, all except humans, that is. Or maybe you've seen the movie version of his book, The Postman. Or you've read his epic novel, Existence, that introduces a variation on First Contact that is simultaneously chilling, entertaining, and thought-provoking. Like me, David lives in the San Diego area, so making it to this year's Starship Congress wasn't difficult. It was held at the Air and Space Museum in beautiful Balboa Park. David joined me for a brief conversation in one of the exhibit halls during a break in the Congress program. Another member of the UCSD Science Fiction Mafia, as I call you guys. Hi, David.
Oh, it's great to be back with the, the people who look up.
That's good, yeah. Keep looking up, as they say. You just got off the stage here at the Starship Congress. I love to listen to you talk because it's great fun. One of the themes, certainly, was Moon versus, not Moon versus Mars, but Moon versus those little rocks out there.
Yeah, Mars has a constituency. I happen to think we're going to have to do something before we do much with Mars, because if we don't build up a space industry, then we may just go to Mars and do what we did with Apollo. And that's a mistake. We should concentrate on things that will help us to make permanent presence out there. Now, those who defend going back to the moon and they say, this time for good, they claim that there are resources there we can exploit. And what I do is I pretty savagely demolish that. The only resource that we know that is of any industrial value or value to humans are two things. One is there seems to be some water ice at the lunar poles. My doctoral advisor was the guy who predicted it would be there. And I hope so. You know, it could leverage lunar colonies in the future. But this whole helium-3 and all of those things, it's all mythological. There are reasons why there are no metal ores at the lunar surface. It's been thrice melted and the metals sank away. Whereas there are some asteroids that are made from the core of a broken planet. In other words, absolutely pure, refined metals. There's water in the asteroids, far more than we could ever get from the lunar poles. Now, am I saying we should never go back to the moon? It all depends on who we are. Humanity is going back to the moon. Absolutely. The Chinese, Indians, Russians, billionaires, they're all desperate to have their, what I would call, bar moonzvas, their rites of passage, their hey, today I am a man, today we are grown-up moments there, and God bless them. They'll spend whatever it takes to do it and plant footprints in that dusty plain, And if they find anything, America can go back to the moon then. We can sell them landers, for crying out loud. The one thing the moon is really good for, that Andy Weir, the author of The Martian, said in his latest novel, Artemis, is tourism. And that's why the Chinese are, and Indians and all that are going there. That's why we went in 1969. Highly motivated tourism. So we should build a lunar orbital station, call it a hotel.
Or a gateway.
And commercial enterprises, Jeff Bezos's lander, Blue Moon lander and all that, sell them, rent them landers, rent them hotel rooms. Welcome to our moon. We've been waiting 50 years for you tourists to come.
Drop in any time, you said.
Yeah. Well, give us a little bit of notice. I mean, for heaven's sake, there's orbital parameters and we have to stock up. I mean, you are billionaires after all. We want the caviar to be ready for you. Asteroids, however, are another story. Within the last 18 months, the Japanese especially, but also America, did several fantastic asteroid missions. Unbelievably competent and glorious asteroid missions that our voters hardly know about. That advanced our progress and our ability to do these things tremendously. America and Japan could team up and do stuff none of the others can do. Why should we repeat doing what others can barely do 50 years after we already did it, when we can do things that are 50 years ahead of them, that can advance human civilization and our capabilities in space?
And I just want to throw in the European Space Agency, because Rosetta.
Well, yeah. I mean, the sample return aspects and some of the lovely details that the Japanese put in their mission. But yes, absolutely. The Europeans straddle both worlds. Mm.
So you must be excited about the Psyche mission, the one that's going to one of those iron nickel asteroids.
Oh, I think that's terrific. That's my doctoral dissertation was on comets and asteroids many, many years ago. I'm not sure how much we can learn from an iron nickel asteroid, because we have samples of iron nickel asteroids that have landed on the Earth, and what are you going to find? A bunch of steel. But I might be wrong. I expect to be delighted.
Back with David Brin after the break. This is Planetary Radio.
Where did we come from? Are we alone in the cosmos? These are the questions at the core of our existence. And the secrets of the universe are out there, waiting to be discovered. But to find them, we have to go into space. We have to explore. This endeavor unites us. Space exploration truly brings out the best in us, encouraging people from all walks of life to work together to achieve a common goal, to know the cosmos and our place within it. This is why the Planetary Society exists. Our mission is to give you the power to advance space science and exploration. With your support, we sponsor innovative space technologies, inspire curious minds, and advocate for our future in space. We are the Planetary Society. Join us.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan, visiting this week with science fiction author, futurist, and NASA advisor David Brin at the recent Starship Congress. David fit right in with that group. Want to hear me talk with a guy who is planning a space elevator with its base on the moon? Or how about someone who wants to use compressed hydrogen gas in a long tube to launch satellites? Or experimental evidence that could mean there are exceptions to the second law of thermodynamics. Perpetual motion, anyone? These and other flights of mind and fancy are in the much longer version of this episode at planetary.org/radio. Let's switch to what really is going on here today, what you're a contributor to, and that is the fact that these people have gotten together here in San Diego to talk about something which
You mentioned Kim Stanley Robinson said in his wonderful book, Aurora, humans may never be able to do, at least not in a generational spaceship that takes 100 or 200 or 500 years to get there, and that's reach other stars. And yet, this still motivates a lot of people, although maybe not as many people as certainly I and maybe you might have hoped would be interested in an event like this.
Well, there are many, many. You said a mouthful there, Matt.
Too much.
No, plenty. I mean, okay, compared to me, yeah. The people within the sound of my voice right now, tuning into planetary radio, we all want to be a civilization that's moving along. These conferences are a bit fannish. On the other hand, you're starting to get some real billionaire monies put into this. Jeff Bezos with his Blue Origin, Elon Musk with SpaceX. But beyond that, you have Yuri Milner's Breakthrough Project, which is funding the preliminary development of laser-driven light sails that might send probes to other stars, similar in concept to the interstellar self-replicating probes that I have in my novel Existence, and that have evolved in some creepy ways. But we're
almost criminal ways.
Yes, well, you know what survives, survives. And it's a very different story than, shall we say, the postman. But in any event, the point is that there are some possible ways in which we might check to see if there are already probes in our solar system that arrived maybe millions of years ago and have been waiting around and have been lurking. They're called lurkers, listening to our radio and then watching our TV and then maybe participating in our reality shows, which is a scary thought in about 40 different ways as an American. The notion that such lurkers might be detectable is a very interesting one. And there are some asteroids that come very close to the Earth that Milner's Breakthrough Project wants to have a look at with radar scans, or possibly looking for the glints off flat or manufactured surfaces if there's a robot on these. And what did I just do? I just warned them.
I certainly hope if there are lurkers and they listen to this show, they can go to, davidbryn.com, and they can contact you and let you know, yeah, we're here. You better shut up about this.
Well, that's actually been something that I have shouted defiantly over radio at UFO and other type lurkers.
I did it once with my father's CB radio in our van.
Oh, yeah. No, you-hoo beasties out there. It's me again. I'm about to give you the phone number of the Jet Propulsion Lab. They'll arrange visas of both kinds. You want to date Madonna? I'm sure she's willing.
You know the great Fire Sign Theater line, aliens, you must register.
Yes, there you are. One of the hypotheses is that we are kept in isolation. Of the 100 explanations for the hypotheses for the so-called Fermi paradox, why we see no sign of aliens, of the 100 or so that I've cataloged over the last 35, 40 years, one of them is, one class is the zoo hypothesis, and one of the zoo hypotheses is we're too valuable to them as reality TV. We're just so entertaining. A few years ago, we were starting to act too sensible, so they intervened to bring reality stars to the fore, and we've become a lot more funny.
So it's not the Truman Show, it's the True Earth Show.
You ought to be on radio.
Back to gatherings like this, though. They continue to happen. You've been a participant in this kind of effort for decades, and yet we're still a long ways from a starship. Why is this a valuable process?
Well, I think we're making progress. It's exactly, pretty much this month, exactly 100 years ago that the Allies at the end of World War I started selling off hundreds, thousands of rickety biplanes to anybody who could pony up $5.
Curtis Jennings, a lot of them.
Yes, and it opened up what was called the barnstorming era. Now, that doesn't mean that governments weren't involved. governments were very involved. Governments provided the mail delivery contracts. They made the airports. They made the roads that went to the airports. Nevertheless, there was a boom in private endeavors. Now, we've seen the preliminary signs of this already with billionaires financing investigations of asteroids. And again, in my novel Existence, I portray mere multimillionaires getting involved in all of this. The barnstorming era, you know, there was an event, a tragic event, 3-4 years ago in which Branson's spaceship 2 crashed and only one of the two pilots survived. The public acted very differently than they had during with the death of official NASA astronauts. There was a bit of an outcry, but very quickly it subsided, and people took the attitude that, well, private endeavors are judged by a different standard. So we may be entering an era in which more and more private endeavors take place and are willing to take greater risks, while the government steps back and works on helping deliver the infrastructure, just as happened 100 years ago.
It is always fun, David. I look forward to seeing you, as we speak now, seeing you in Huntsville in about a week at the NIAC Symposium.
That's right. NIAC is NASA's Innovative and Advanced Concepts Program. I'm on the Council of External Advisors, and we'll be at Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville looking at some of the NIAC funds, some of the small grants for some of the ideas that are just this side of science fiction, which is doing what NASA ought to do. And you should be proud as taxpayers that a little bit gets spent on ideas that are just this side of weird.
I am. Thanks, David.
And thank you, all my fellow geeks out there. Ride high. This is our time.
Time to close out yet another episode of Planetary Radio, as we always do, with Bruce Betts, the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, also the program manager for LightSail 2, still going strong up there. How are you? You going strong?
Yeah. Yes, I'm going strong, Matt.
That's more like it. That's the right stuff.
Just speaking with you has made my life stronger.
It only takes moments, doesn't it?
It really does.
What's up?
Strong stuff, but in the evening sky, Jupiter, it's dropping lower. It's been hanging with us for months, but it's still there. Brightest star-like object in the southwest after sunset. To its upper left is yellowish Saturn, which will be around longer. It is hanging out above Sagittarius and the teapot of Sagittarius, so check all those out. We move on to this week in space history. It was 5 years ago, 2014, that both MAVEN and the Mars Orbiter mission went into orbit around Mars, just adding to the fleet of Mars orbiters.
Time is going much too quickly.
It really is. There's some type of age-dependent relativistic effect. I'm going to write a paper on it at some point.
Yeah, please do.
I don't think that'll help us, though.
That would be what? The biological theory of relativity or something.
Exactly. Perfect. You can be a co-author.
Thank you. I've always wanted to be on a co-author on a paper.
We move on to random freeze.
That sounded like the Indy 500.
Oh, gosh. It really doesn't work when your engine's voice cracks. All right. So
I thought it was okay.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Matt. See, that's why you make my life stronger. There are at least 54 satellite galaxies tied to the Milky Way, gravitationally hanging out with the Milky Way. There are a whole bunch of them hanging out with the Andromeda Galaxy as well. Yeah, that's right. That's right. You heard what I said. And there are probably a lot more because that whole Milky Way thing gets in the way of seeing stuff on the other side. So most of these are dwarf galaxies. We'll come back to that. But it's just a little something to note that we got a bunch of stuff hanging around with us.
Had no idea. I mean, I knew about the greater and lesser Magellanic Clouds. I thought that was it, but 54.
Well, they're big and fun and visible in dark skies from the southern hemisphere with the just your eyes. But whereas most of the others aren't, being smaller or farther away. All right, we move on to the trivia contest. And I asked you, name the last three Venus orbiters.
Here's the answer from our poet laureate, Dave Fairchild. Venus doesn't get the love that other planets do. Akatsuki was the last to orbit. That is true. If you research through the list, I'm rather prone to guess. The one before that lander we have called Venus Express. Magellan made insertion during 1990's scene. And last behind Magellan was Venera, Flight 16. So he gave you four.
Bonus points.
Yeah. Thank you, Dave. Nicely done. By the way, it was Paul Swan in Texas who pointed out that those four most recent Venus orbiters, they all came from different agencies, four different space agencies over all those years. Nice observation.
Yeah.
But you're waiting for the winner. It was Adam Ledak, or Ledak, in Toronto. Great city. What a wonderful town. He came up with the three that we were looking for, Akatsuki, Venus Express, and Magellan. And he said, Akatsuki, great example that success is not final and failure is not fatal. I'm not sure who he's quoting there, but he says, as always, love the podcast. I guess that's because Akatsuki had its problems reaching Venus, didn't it?
It did. It failed to enter orbit its first time around, and they came up with a clever solution. They had to wait a few years as things lined up again, but then they were able to get into orbit. So it is a nice example of tenacity, persistence, and fixing things in space when they go wrong.
Yeah. And I'll remind everybody that you can learn more about Venus in the current issue of the Planetary Report, as we discussed with Emily Lakdawalla, editor of the magazine, not very many minutes ago. Adam, our winner, he's getting a Planetary Radio t-shirt from Chop Shop. You can go to chopshopstore.com, by the way, and see the entire Planetary Society store there. Fantastic designs. A 200-point iTelescope.net astronomy account and a signed copy of a certain book, Super Cool Space Facts, a fun fact.
Oh, I hear that's good.
A fun fact-filled space book for kids by some guy named Bruce Betts. We're ready for the next one.
Satellite galaxies of the Milky Way is the topic. I want you to name your three favorite Milky Way satellite galaxies. There's no right answer other than in your heart, as long as they're considered satellite galaxies of the Milky Way, go to planetary.org/radio contest.
So they have to be real satellite galaxies, right?
Yes.
You can't have people, I mean, you want to make one up, go ahead, but it's not going to help you win the contest.
Yeah, it needs to be the fourth one. You need three that are real.
You've got until the 25th, that'd be September 25 at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us this answer, and we'll send you a Planetary Radio t-shirt and maybe a 200-point iTelescope.net astronomy account as well.
All right, we done?
Yeah.
Okay, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about if you lived in a dwarf galaxy, what would you call galaxies like the Milky Way? Thank you, and good night.
I'm just still thinking of names for the dwarf galaxies, like Sleepy and Sneezy and Grumpy, or is it Grouchy? I forget. Anyway, he's Bruce Betts. He's none of those. Well, sometimes. He's the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its star-crossed members. Mark Hilverde is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which was arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. I'm Matt Kaplan, at Astro.